Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business. My name's Patrick Gray. Seriously Risky Biz is the podcast we do here at Risky Biz HQ, which is a discussion of the newsletter by the same name, which is written by Tom Uren, my colleague, who joins me now. G'day, Tom.
G'day, Patrick. How are you?
Good, good. And this edition of Seriously Risky Biz is brought to you by Tynes, who do, you know, security automation that's really quite impressive. We actually have a product demo of Tynes up on our YouTube page, which is Risky Biz Product Demos. It's great stuff. Their users rave about them. They're a sponsor of the show. Solid endorse on that one. They're really, really good. We'd also like to thank Lawfare and the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative for supporting the work Tom does with us here at Risky Biz HQ. And I said Risky Biz HQ twice. But that's okay. We're just gonna roll with it because we're a day late. And the reason we're a day late is because I was actually quite ill yesterday. I've been trying to get over what can best be described as toddler plague, which my son brought home to the house. And it's been a rough week. But I am on the mend. So let's get into it, Tom. And you've written up the White House report into memory safe languages. So the White House issues a report through the Office of the National
Cyber Director.
So they released a report saying that everyone should use MemSafe languages. And when we spoke about this on the weekly Risky Biz podcast, I was like, well, I don't really understand the point of this, because even if you solve that problem, you've got other problems and whatever. But you have put together a pretty compelling case here that says that what the White House has done here is not a waste of its time. It's very good advice. Memory safety issues are still a massive proportion of, you know, the overall sort of problems that that plague modern software. So, you know, all in all, this is just a very good thing.
Yeah, so the report's interesting. It's kind of following the same major thrust of the whole national cybersecurity strategy, in that you want to provide incentives for everyone to do better. So the idea is, product makers make better products and people buy better products. So that's the whole thrust of the, it supports that thrust. There's a long-term part, which is we just need to get better at figuring out what is secure software. And that feels so long-term. It's like, oh, well, okay, yeah, maybe that'll happen. I don't know. But then there's this very specific part where it says one way to get better now is to employ memory safe languages. And it actually dives into what does memory safety mean, what memory safety vulnerabilities are. And if you don't know, it's about computers allocating memory. And if you make a mistake doing that, that provides all sorts of opportunities for malicious people to come along and take advantage. And there's a whole, many different classes that fall under that.
Yeah,
and this document actually goes into different types. And in the old days, programmers had to do that. I want to use the word manually. They actually had to tell the program how to do it, how to allocate memory, how to remove it. And it's just super easy to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And so people make mistakes all the time.
I mean, I studied C and C++ at university a million years ago, and I remember like just how tedious it was when you had to define an array or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And so these bugs have been around for a very, very long time. So the first documented reference to one is from 1972. So it's like, 52 years old?
Yeah, wow.
And there's, they've been well-known publicly since the late 90s. And there have been a whole series of steps to try and mitigate them, including hardware and even OS-level mitigations that have been employed in Windows and macOS and iOS and a whole lot of places. And they're still around. So yeah. The most recent data I could find is that Google's tracks O-Day it finds in the wild, and it does actually a good job of categorizing them into what sort of vulnerability they are. And last year, it was something like 75% of the O-Day they found in the wild was related to memory safety issues. And so there's one data set that indicates that for today, well, last year, it's still a big problem that actors are taking advantage of.
Well, and it's a problem. I think the interesting thing is it's a problem with a fairly clear solution. I mean, we even had a bit of a powwow about this yesterday, you, myself, and Adam Boileau. And I was like, you know, even stuff like Heartbleed, right, which wasn't like a memory corruption vulnerability, but it was a memory safety vulnerability, right? Like, it, you know, you just save yourself so much drama by using memory safe languages, and they're fast now. Right? Like memory safe languages used to be like hideous, slow, awful, and it's just not the case anymore. Like it is actually a viable strategy to eradicate these types of issues.
Yeah, yeah. One of the questions is why now? Why not 10, 20, yeah, 30, that was the 40, question 50 Adam years ago?
On yesterday's show, yeah.
Yeah. And to me, the answer is because the languages that are fast enough are only 10 years old.
Yeah.
So the ones people talk about are Go, Swift and Rust. It, like there's others, I'm sure, but those are the ones most commonly cited. And that's like just over 10 to just under 10 years old. And that feels like a length of time where you can get the warm fuzzies about how they perform and that they're not going to do weird stuff. And that's how long it takes people, I think, to get confidence that you can do that. And so these programs are already being used in some places. So Google's using Rust in its Android development.
Yeah.
And so they published a chart that shows that the more they used Rust, the less memory safety problems they have. So that's not it's a strong evidence.
Yes.
It's not absolute proof, but there's a correlation there that feels convincing. Similarly,
I think we've seen Microsoft overhaul certain little chunks of Windows in MemSafe languages, like, you know, a small percentage, but it's, you know, they're chipping away at it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And that seems to be the vibe I get from those companies. Both Microsoft and Google say, you know, we're trying to use these memory safe languages. We're experimenting. We're pushing on the edge. We're doing new stuff in Rust. Or yeah. Go or whatever.
I mean, I wouldn't expect that a bunch of these enterprise software vendors are going to all of a sudden re-architect and, you know, recreate their software in memory safe languages. But I think the message here is that, you know, if you're a startup developing some software, you know, don't use C or C++ or, you know, don't use one of these old school dangerous languages because the White House thinks that's a bad idea. And, you know, things have a habit of being best practice one day and then table stakes the next. And I think that's really the message here, is that this is going to be, this is a recommendation at this point, but, you know, say 5-10 years down the track, that's going to be an expectation. So if you're kicking off Greenfield's products, you would be mad not to use MemSafe languages at this point.
Yeah, I think that's the target audience
yeah.
for this document. It's Google, Microsoft, I think Apple, it probably is on board because why wouldn't they?
Well, it's just Apple runs its PR like it's North Korea, right?
That's right, yeah. they're on board. They're pushing out that direction. But I think it's the people who would go, we're starting a new project, will you see? Because that's what people have always used.
Yeah.
That's the people this document is aimed at, and to get them to change their mind on day zero.
Now, another thing that you briefly touched on there, and it's only talked about briefly in the newsletter as well, is this other idea of like how we should have better measurability of the security of software and, you know, to help the market make better decisions. You were like, expressed a bit of skepticism and then moved on to the memory safety stuff. And I had the same reaction because, you know, we for a long time we thought stuff like, you know, CVEs and then CVSS, you know, if you kept seeing high impact, you know, high CVSS score CVEs in software, you would think the market would move away from those tools. But that absolutely hasn't been the experience. I feel like there's a bit of naivety here at the White House office of the National Cyber Director, because I just don't know that better data is going to actually influence market decisions here.
Look, I'm going to disagree, and I think it would. I think the problem in the past is that there was no... it never came back to bite you in a really serious way. So you could buy crap software, you could get compromised. Your share price, if you were a public company, would dip for 6 months, and then Bob's your uncle.
Yeah,
that's an Australian saying for saying everything that's fine.
Robert's your mother's brother.
Whereas I think if you knew beforehand, like it would be, it kind of feels stupid not to take that into account. Like, you know, you would look at the, here's the security stars. You know, this one's got 1 star, this one's got 3 stars. We can justify paying a bit more for the 3 stars. It's just that doesn't exist. And the document's quite funny in that it goes through, like it actually says software measurability is one of the hardest open research problems to address. And then it steps through all the reasons that it's really hard. Mm. And then it says, but we still think it's worthwhile.
And but yeah, I mean, look, if you had a magic lens that you could throw over enterprise software and give them like a star rating, 1 through 5, right? If some company consistently buys 1 star software and then gets owned, loses a bunch of customer data, yeah, maybe there's some SEC action or something. You know, but I just sort of wonder, you know, this entire idea is predicated on that magic lens.
You know? Right, yeah.
Which is why, okay, sure, observability would be nice, but if we had, you know, that's a pretty magic capability is what I'm getting at. Like true metrics here, very, very hard.
Yeah, I am similarly skeptical. It felt like something that I put 1 sentence in the newsletter? And then I won't have to deal with it for the rest of my career.
And moving on. Yes.
That's right.
Pretty much. All right. So people can go check that one out at news.risky.biz. And we've got a couple other items we're going to discuss quickly here. But that was a very interesting write-up. And you did change my mind on that because I was on the weekly show saying, you know, what's the point? And you made a really compelling case that this was, a great initiative from the White House. And I'm a believer now. So thanks for that.
Good.
Thanks for the course correction on that. Now let's talk about the Attorney General in Nevada. They have they've filed a motion to stop Meta providing end-to-end encryption on the Messenger app. So this was something that Meta announced recently, which is like by default, everything's going to be encrypted. And the state's motion says there's a strong interest in immediately protecting Nevada children, because encryption on Messenger enables predators to stalk young users with impunity. You get where they're coming from, but the point you're making is that child safety is a bigger issue than just banning, encryption, end-to-end encryption on messages.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of read those two sentences you read out, and it kind of implies that the presence of encryption stops people from preventing crime. And I don't think that's the way it works. I don't think there's people like... I guess, is it tapping those messages, watching those messages in real time and leaping out and stopping something bad happen? So it seems to me that it's about, it's just easier to serve a warrant on Meta to get content if it's not encrypted than it is to get devices. And now, if you were going to do something else with unencrypted messages, something like scanning or, I don't know, maybe some sort of magical machine learning thing that can figure out when messages become suspicious. Like, I actually can see a case for that. I'm open to that idea. Now, if you could show that that was worth the privacy cost, I would accept that. But that's not what it's about. It's just about we're going to stop encryption, full stop.
Yeah.
So it makes sense in the context of a sort of system where you've got a whole lot of, I guess compensating controls would be the... or other controls that would also make it more effective.
This is a conversation that comes up anytime we talk about anything to do with child safety, right? Because you've got, you know, reactionaries on this side saying encryption's a witch. It's a witch. You know, burn it. And then on the other side, you've got people saying, oh, this is about the surveillance state and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, both takes are equally as dumb because the, you know, as you say, and then, you know, people talk about introducing client-side scanning, which was an idea that came out of Apple. And, you know, there was a huge pushback on that, so much so that they had to abandon it. I mean, I would have thought basic client-side scanning to determine when people are, you know, just image hash scanning, looking for known CSAM, would be a pretty uncontroversial idea. And yet it's not, because the sort of retail politics around this is completely nuts. And I just sort of wonder, I mean, this feels like an easy win politically for the Nevada Attorney General to be able to say, look, you know, I'm taking action to protect the kids, yada, yada, yada. It sort of feels like that, right? Yeah. Rather than listening to the experts and trying to do something real.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what would make sense, I think, is, you know, maybe messages from random adults to children, they get some sort of special treatment, whatever that is. And it doesn't necessarily have to be encryption or anything to do with encryption, but it could be. But I would be open to that idea. And some sort of scanning or vetting would be kind of fine. But it really depends on what you're doing as a whole. Like, I think treating any one of these things just in isolation is...
It's folly, Tom.
Yeah.
There you go. That's the right word. It's okay. Folly. Now, just before we wrap it up, you wrote a short little reference to a Wired piece. Well, it's an excerpt, actually, from a book, which really looks at the power of using data, location data bought on public exchanges and whatever, to track people, right? And this... You know, and this is a topic that you've covered quite in depth over the last couple of years with us. And, you know, they were able to track Vladimir Putin by looking at phones of people in his entourage. They were able to track, military personnel moving between, you know, fixed positions in Syria and then back to the United States, and people who were like, well, that's an aid worker and that's a this and that's a that. And it was just amazing, the sort of insight that could be gleaned by looking at this information. Couple of thoughts I had, though, is, well, you know, I'm pretty sure that these types of capabilities, locating devices, things like that, that's stuff that, you know, Five Eyes, SIGINT agencies are good at already. So while it's great that you can, you know, track Putin with this commercial data, the thing that occurred to me is that, well, nations that can't afford the big fancy SIGINT programs can now do that to us by using this sort of data. So I sort of feel like, to a degree, the point was lost a bit here. You know, do you know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying. So the book...
Because they're like, oh, look, we can track Putin. It's like, guys, we can already do that, but now they can track us.
Yeah, yeah. Stuff. So the book is Means of Control. And the subtitle is How the Hidden Alliance of Tech and Government is Creating a New American Surveillance State.
Now, missing the point.
That's exactly what point. I thought. I was tempted to put some sort of rant into the newsletter about it. Like, So I haven't read the book. I think the examples it cited were very plausible.
But you're going to sell more books saying this is about big, scary US government secret deep state agencies than you are, you know, selling a book saying, hey, this is a way for the MSS to track people cheaply. Exactly. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's just a better hook, man. Yeah. Like, way up on the Amazon bestseller list by doing it that way.
Yeah, yeah. So that's I had exactly the same problem with that framing. To me, it feels more like the government is, like, there probably are, like, groups taking advantage of that kind of data, but it's there's no alliance. They're the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, where you landed when you've been covering this stuff for us is that, and there's an executive order at the moment that's going to ban sales of this sort of information to countries like Iran and China and, you know, Russia and wherever. But, you know, you've argued in previous opinions that you've written for us that this seems a pretty dumb way to fix the problem. And the way to really fix this problem is to ban the collection of this type of information in the first place. You know, ban the collection and storage of location information. It doesn't really serve, you know, the risks outweigh the rewards. And, you know, the United States and, you know, other countries really need comprehensive, robust privacy legislation to address this risk. And I guess that's still your position. I'd be surprised if it's not.
Yeah. So I think I've spent a lot of time thinking about these issues, right? And what's curious to me is that for individuals, and the Gruck and I have podcasted about this, there's very rarely any publicly reported like bad outcomes for it. And you look at FTC cases and they're struggling to find what the actual harms are. So I actually really think it's about where you are in geopolitical competition, right? 20 years ago, it probably didn't make much difference because we weren't in a world where countries were possibly going to go to war with each other, like with the US in particular. But now the world has changed and there are very aggressive espionage groups that will use this type of data and take advantage of it every day of the week. So maybe that's my sort of latest position where it's worth doing something about because the world has changed. Not necessarily, I suppose the types of data we can get has also gotten a lot more.
Yeah, I guess but I'd when use you say we should intrusive. Do something, I mean, are you talking about restricting the collection of this stuff or the dissemination or both? Because I think
it's
you're
gotta
right
be both.
When you say, but I think you're right when you say it's like restricting the collection is the better solution.
Yeah. If you restrict the collection, it can never be used for anything, right? Yeah. I think it is tricky in that there are, I think, legitimate uses for geolocation data. It's very useful for stuff.
Some stuff though, Tom. Like I'll give you an example. I've got a weather app that's really good. And it's like a paid app. It cost me $4 years ago. Terrific. I love it. When there's rain coming, it makes a little noise. It's fantastic. Now, that one needs my location. So it can tell me when it's going to rain. Does it need to store that location? Does it need a historical record of where I've been, Tom? Or does it just need to know where I am at that moment? You know, and that's what I'm getting at, right? So I think a lot of most of the time, these apps only need to know where you are in a transient way. And when it comes to apps like, Apple Maps, Google Maps, okay, sure, you can have that like location tracking turned on so you can see where you've been and whatever. Google's not selling that info. Apple's not selling that info, right? They're actually quite good about that. So where it comes in is all of these other little apps. Mm-hmm. And I really struggle to think of how many of them, why any of them would need to keep a log of that data. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, certainly what they don't need to do is collect your location when you're using or playing a game to sell to someone else.
Exactly. Yeah, you shouldn't need to provide your location to play Candy Crush.
That's right.
Yeah.
So some of the data broker stories I've covered, that's exactly what they're doing. They're getting the seller of location data is getting their SDK placed in games and other just random stuff in order to be able to harvest locations to sell them. And that's, we don't need that. It's not something we need.
Yeah, that's it. All right. Well, Tom, you're in. Fascinating as always to speak to you, my friend. Thank you for your wonderful work on the newsletter. And again, sorry to everyone for everything being late this week. It's, as I say, toddler grade virus has put me down this week. But we'll chat to you again next week. And cheers again.
Thanks, Pat.